Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI celebrates the fifth anniversary of his pontificate. Two journalists, both of them Vatican affairs experts, look back on these 5 years with some personal considerations. Vatican Radio Zema McCarthy, who travelled with the Pope to Malta on his first apostolic journey to the island, describes her feelings and her thoughts at the end of the weekend visit. A descriptive mural on the wall of the Jesuit Refugee Service office in Malta tells of the tragic journey of hope undertaken by millions who cross the sea in search of a better life. On April the 19th, 2005, that's exactly 5 years ago, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger was elected Pope, becoming the 266th Roman Pontiff and taking the name Benedict XVI. As is customary on these occasions, one tends to look back, to pinpoint some of the highlights of the pontificate so far, and maybe single out some of its peculiarities. To do this, I spoke to former Vatican radio journalist David Gibson. But before getting to the point, I asked him, why don't you introduce yourself?
I am an American journalist and a convert to Catholicism. Went back to the States. I've been covering religion, all religions, but real emphasis on Catholicism in the United States and abroad. Written a couple of books, one latest a biography of Joseph Ratzinger as Pope.
Is it one of the few biographies in the bookshops
today? Yeah, there were a couple of quickie biographies. Mine came out a couple of years after he was Pope.
The Rule of Benedict, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly, The Rule of Benedict, not an original title. Pope Benedict XVI and His Battle with the Modern World. As I say, there were a couple of quick ones, and I call mine a smart quickie, in the sense that it came out about 2 years after he was elected Pope.
So we're speaking today as we celebrate 5 years from the beginning of Benedict's papacy. Looking back these 5 years, what would you think are the traits or the most significant characteristics that we'll remember?
I think it depends on the time frame. You know, right now, there's so much of this sort of crisis mode that's going on, at least in the coverage of the Vatican and in some of the reactions that you've seen from his collaborators. There's that tendency to think, oh, this will be the defining characteristic of his papacy. And I don't know. It could be a difficult point and stretch he's going through. But I think, you know, further on, as with any leader, there will come to be a better and more considered judgment. And I think the first thing that people will remember is what people were surprised by when he first became Pope, which is what a nice man he is, what a pastor he is, and, you know, how approachable he has been. When he came to the United States in 2008, his first and could be only a visit to the United States exactly 2 years ago, the response was really warm. And it was, again, I think the benefit of low expectations. People thought, oh, here's this German cardinal, Joseph Ratzinger, the theologian, scholar.
The watchdog.
Yes, exactly, who followed the wonderful John Paul II, you know, who was wonderful in so many ways. But here he comes. And he was very engaging and very thoughtful and very warm. And people said, oh, he is a nice guy. He is a real pastor. And so, again, I think really from the moment he walked out on the balcony of there, St. Peter's Square, and when he was elected, that really is struck and stuck with people. And there's been a real, obviously, dip with that now, at least in the United States and in some other places. But I think that's going to remain. And I think his writings will remain, which is what he would like to see.
Right.
You know, the reality is, and in writing about Benedict, it's so clear that he does not want to be the center of attention. You know, he said in his opening homily as Pope, it's not about me, it's about letting Christ shine through me. And when he said that in his discourse about the priests
right.
the other day. Yeah.
But right at the beginning, if I
exactly.
remember.
Exactly, and just yesterday when he
balcony.
Talked about,
mm-hmm.
yeah, when he talked about priests, what their job is. So he does not want to be the center. He wants, if anything, he wants his writings to remain. And I think, indeed, they will. He's grown into his role, I think, as Pope and a public figure and a statesman and all that sort of thing, which is nothing he aspired to. Part of the job. That's why they pay him the big money, as we say. But I think his writings, his Jesus books, there's a second book on Jesus coming out, his encyclicals.
His three encyclicals.
Yeah, those are really, I think, going to endure. The other thing is obviously his liturgical reform of the reform, if you will. I think that hasn't even taken effect yet. It will in the next year or 2 years and coming years, some of the reforms in the Mass and the example that he's set in terms of a kind of more sober, more sacred kind of celebration of the liturgy. I think that will be a real legacy that people will start noticing. It's a legacy that people haven't even realized
right.
yet. It's something that has been put into place, but there's always a delayed reaction. This is the Catholic Church after all, so it takes a few years to kick in.
He's been unlucky in these 5 years in the sense that he's really been confronted with almost cyclical crises. Mm. And he's had to really navigate through stormy waters, and that would put anyone to test, I think. Do you think he'll be remembered for having also stood up to the storm?
I think so, very much. And you're right. Increasingly, especially with this latest kind of crisis, you could almost kind of mark his papacy by this series of peaks and valleys and this kind of a chronology of crises, Regensburg to the Richard Williamson, Lefebvreist issues. And I think what he has done and which will hold him in good stead is that he's always maintained a steady course. I think you're seeing that in its quintessence during this crisis, which is so much of a media type of crisis rather than, you know, an issue of kind of internal church disputes, et cetera, that you know, he reads the newspapers, but he knows that they're newspapers and that in a month or 6 months or a year, that news cycle will have died off and people will be moving on to something else. He's going to stay his course, and he's always done that, even when he's, quote-unquote, apologized after Regensburg, after the Richard Williamson rehabilitation issue. There are more of explanations. This is what I was thinking. It's a precisazione. It's more of a, you know, explaining, clarifying, saying this is what I was doing. I still support what I said or what I'm doing. And he's just explaining further and he's waiting it out. He's not going to go with the 24-hour news cycle.
He's good at explaining as well, don't you think? I mean, even when he has his weekly Angelus and he speaks of the gospel, I think his explanations of you know, the readings are very direct and very effective. I don't know if you agree with that.
Very much so. That's the other thing that's going to be a legacy. I think his Wednesday general audiences are going to be those reflections he's given. They've already been published, some of them, in a book. I'm talking to a couple secular journalists just this morning, and they were saying how, you know, they love reading him. Everybody, you know, people who are seen as his critics or his foes, quote unquote, really respect his thinking. He's the smartest man in the Vatican and the hierarchy in many respects. He's so good at explaining the faith and so good at explaining church history and concepts and culture. His expositions on art and the importance of that to the spiritual life, those are incomparable, really. And those are going to, I think, last, perhaps. They're certainly not getting any coverage these days and often don't get coverage and just because of the way the media cycle goes. So I think, he is the great explainer. He's more of a catechist in chief than anything else.
What would you say his most endearing trait is? Something that, you know, the ordinary person in the square can relate to.
He's a really sweet man. I mean, really, he's a very gentle man. And I don't know if this is an endearing trait. I mean, obviously, he likes cats and things like that. That's nice. But the endearing thing, I think, is I think people identify with him as the successor to John Paul II and as a man who really didn't ask for this job. And all things being equal, probably wouldn't want to be doing this job and having to do all these public events. And yet someone who takes on that as something that's been given to him by God, that's been given to him as part of the course of his ministry, and that not something he's taking on as a burden or a suffering to be projected, but something that he takes on with a certain gladness, even if, you know, it wouldn't be his choice. And I think that's the great example. I think that's what people identify with. Here's somebody, you know, who was ready to retire, goodness knows when the conclave happened, and now he's not going to get to.
Do you plan on writing any more books about Joseph Ratzinger?
Well, if it keeps going this way, I'll have to do another major update. It may be time for the TV movie at this point. Who knows? I think I think that would have to mature a bit more. Joseph Ratzinger is writing the book of his papacy now, I think. And that's, I think, even when I was writing the biography that I wrote, my temptation was to say, oh, you should just go back and read him. It was a bit daunting. You never had such a pope with such a legacy of print already of so many books and interviews on that kind of thing. I think I'd rather write about conversion next, both in the Catholic sense and in the broader sense. It's such a fascinating thing, and people are always so interested in what conversion is and why. So these days, always, you know, in the kind of secular world in America, people are like, why did you become a Catholic? And why did you become a Catholic after being at the Vatican?
Well, so you're not going to get away with that just like that. You'll be back here.
I will be
us
back
why.
To tell you, yes, okay. Yeah, in 10 minutes or less.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank
Unless
you,
there's anything else you'd like to.
No, I think it's, you know, it is what it is. The anniversary of the pontificate is going to be a marker for a lot of people, those of us in the media, but I'm not sure it's such a marker for Benedict himself. He's looking beyond that, and I think that's kind of typical of the way his approach.
You've been listening to American journalist David Gibson, author, amongst other works, of a biography on Pope Benedict XVI. And now it's the turn of another journalist and Vatican affairs expert from the other side of the ocean. He is Marco Politi, biographer of Pope John Paul II, currently columnist for the Italian daily Il Fatto Quotidiano. I put more or less the same questions to him and asked him to single out what he sees as the main characteristics of Pope Benedict XVI's pontificate.
Benedict XVI is not at all the stereotype, as many times in Anglo-Saxon countries or in Germany, they speak about the great inquisitor, about the watchdog of orthodoxy, or the panzer cardinal. If you know him personally, he's very sensible, he's even timid, he's warm, he's witty, he is full of good humor. And certainly he's a great spiritual and intellectual personality. Reading his books or his speeches is very stimulating also for non-believers. And I was struck many times by the fact how in little parishes he can explain the gospel with very simple and capturing words. So he has a high message, but which he can give in a very clear way also to very simple people. I think that his encyclicals will stay and will be remembered as a way of focusing on the essentials of the Christian message, which is especially in a time of fundamentalism and of bloody clashes between groups, between religions. He has succeeded in conveying the message that Christianity must be a religion of love. But this love must be on all levels. You can't go to the altar and say you love God if you don't love your neighbor in a very concrete way. So this means that every Christian, in praying on one part, in the same time must work actively to bring justice, peace, and respect for human dignity and of the human person in the world, all over the world. This is a very important message nowadays. On the other side, there is a certain tragic in the pontificate of Benedict XVI, because this high-level spiritual personality is confronted cyclically with crisis within the Church, and with his pontificate. So there was a crisis with Islam, there was a crisis with the Jews, there was a crisis within the Catholic world about the abolishing of the excommunication of the Lefebvrean bishops. There was this crisis with the public opinion about the statements over the condom and the AIDS. And this is something tragic in this pontificate, because there is not one year in which there is no crisis.
So he's quite good at navigating crises, would you say?
Well, it is difficult for him. Maybe it depends on the fact that he is more a thinker and a preacher than to have the temperament of a political leader.
One last thing. Do you have any personal memory of Pope Benedict XVI? Do you have any personal anecdote that you can recount to us?
Well, I have. I remember that during the last trip to Czechoslovakia of the Pope, I went to greet him because I was finishing my period of working in La Repubblica, because 82 of us are forced to pay pension. And when I came, he welcomed me very warmly and was immediately joking. If you have to leave with 58 years, then I should have left already from a lot of times. And what will you do? Will you write other books? And so people don't know that many times that his idea of Christianity is not a sort that the gospel is a package of vetoes or of prohibitions. He supports more the idea of a joyous being, Christian, to be convinced, but also with what he calls the Bavarian joy of the colors and of the music. And that's the hidden part of Benedict XVI.
That was Vatican Affairs expert Marco Politi, biographer of Pope John Paul II and currently columnist for the Italian daily Il Fatto Quotidiano. Pope Benedict, meanwhile, is resting briefly in the Vatican after his intense weekend journey to the island of Malta. He arrived there on Saturday afternoon and was immediately caught up in a whirlwind of events that included a meeting with victims of clerical sex abuse, an open-air mass, an encounter with young people. Vatican Radio's Emma McCarthy travelled to Malta with the Pope and sent us her final thoughts on the just-concluded journey.
Two images remained burned in the mind of many of those of us who accompanied Pope Benedict XVI to Malta. The face of Lawrence Grech, a victim of abuse by clergy as a child, in the aftermath of his personal encounter with the Pope in the chapel of the Apostolic Nuncio in Rabat. The rosary gifted him by Pope Benedict hung around his neck, and his words, peace, closure, courage. The second is the face of Pope Benedict, the face of an 83-year-old man at the helm of a church that of late has had to face the worst of storms. And in the worst of storms, the pastor of the Universal Church came to Malta, the same Mediterranean island where 1,950 years ago Paul ran aground and first gave Christian hope to the Maltese people, a faith that down through the centuries remains undiminished. In Acts, the saint himself writes of the people's hospitality. From Pope Benedict XVI's arrival at Lucca International Airport Saturday evening, the people stood four deep on the pavements to greet him. In Valletta, the children filled the air with their song. In St. Paul's Grotto, the Living Church of Malta presented Pope Benedict with their missionary sons and daughters, descendants of the great evangelizer. Twice the Pope appealed to them not to abandon their faith, not to allow the winds of secularism that blow from the continent of Europe distract them. At Mass in Granary Square, Floriana, he said no visitor to Malta could fail to be impressed by the devotion of its people.
So a vibrant faith manifested in your feast day celebrations, the beauty of your churches and shrines. But that gift needs to be shared with others. It needs to be articulated.
To the 10,000 young people who had sung themselves hoarse waiting for their Pope as he crossed Grand Harbour, to the sound of ship horn and cannon, he told them not to give in to peer pressure in a Europe where gospel values are now counterculture.
You should be proud that your county boasts defends the unborn and promotes stable family life by saying no to abortion and divorce. I urge you to maintain this courageous witness to the sanctity of life and the centrality of marriage and family life for a healthy society.
At Lucca Airport Sunday evening, the Pope gave the entire nation a missionary mandate.
Be an example at home and abroad of dynamic Christian living. Be proud of your Christian vocation. Cherish your religious and cultural heritage. Look to the future with hope, with profound respect for God's creation, with reverence for human life, and with high esteem for marriage and the integrity of the family. Cuno ulit denita San Paul.
But one memory will remain with me in particular. The memory of Father John Cassar, a Jesuit priest from Malta, and the refugee's mural on the wall of his office that spoke of war and of violence, sea journeys and detention, but also of a window of blue Maltese sky and the promise of hope. As he took his leave from Malta Sunday evening, Pope Benedict's parting words were one of charity.
I'm aware of the difficulties that welcome a large number of people may cause, difficulties which cannot be solved by any country of first arrival on its own. At the same time, I'm also confident that on the strength of its Christian roots and its long and proud history of welcoming strangers, Malta will endeavor, with the support of other states and international organizations, to come to the aid of those who arrive here and to ensure that their rights be respected.
From Malta with Pope Benedict XVI, I'm Emer McCarthy.
The memory, Emer says, that will remain with her in particular is an encounter with Jesuit priest Father Joseph Cassar, director of Jesuit Refugee Service in Malta. She went to see him when she arrived on the island ahead of the Pope's visit and couldn't help but be struck by a mural on the walls of his office. It's a vivid work painted by four people, quite significantly from Liberia, Ivory Coast, Eritrea and Congo. Silently but forcefully, it speaks of war and of violence, of sea journeys and detention. But, she points out, it also has a window on the blue Maltese sky and contains the promise of hope.
There are four different sections to this mural, which was drawn by African asylum seekers and people who are given protection in Malta. It describes different stages of the journey and of reaching Europe. In the first section, which is predominantly red in color, and therefore one can immediately associate that with blood, with violence, we see huts burning. There are soldiers attacking villages, huts which are on fire, children who are still holding footballs on their heads and being led away by an armed soldier. Then moving to the right, in the background there is a hut burning, a woman who's got her hands in handcuffs, and the soldier is leading her away with the children crying. Then the red and the brown give way to a lighter brown, which is the brown of the sands. Now, this is evidently because all the people who would have reached Malta from sub-Saharan Africa would have had to cross the Sahara Desert. And the tragedy of crossing the Sahara Desert, I say the tragedy, not just the journey, but the tragedy of crossing the Sahara Desert is made evident by the many skeletons which are to be seen in the background, including vehicles full of skeletons, and also people who are seen to have wandered away from broken down vehicles and would have died in the desert. One can also see vultures approaching cars which are still full of dead bodies. And a man wandering in the desert, going nowhere really. The third section of the mural, behind the sand mountains, which are indicated by the middle split on the entire mural, this is predominantly green, and it's the green of the Libyan flag. It denotes Libya. One can see that by the style of housing, which are no longer huts, but which are typically Mediterranean, Arab, North African houses. And there are people trying to leave. There are people who are trying to leave the Libyan coast, backed on motor launches or else on small boats. And we can see that people are trying to leave the coast of Libya, quite evidently, all huddled on small boats which are about to sink, and some of them are actually going under. So in this section of the picture, you can actually see a woman who's holding up her baby quite high so as to save him from drowning. Another African man going under, more people falling overboard and also drowning while others are trying to swim to the shore. Many, of course, from what we know, do not know how to swim, having seen the sea only for the first time.
A number of other people are being rescued by motor launches, white motor launches this time, which would be from the Maltese rescue or else patrol boats, and are then brought into Malta. Unfortunately, beautiful Malta is depicted in grey for the most part, and I wouldn't blame the people who drew this picture, because for them it's a very grey existence. They are first met with detention, even as asylum seekers are detained. And in the case of many of the people who are currently here in Malta, they would have been detained for several months. Less so in the last few months of 2009, but for the most part people would have spent 7, 8, 9, 10 or even 12 months in detention. And the grim reality of detention is shown by the predominantly grey colour, but then by people lying down or sitting on bunk beds — there is no other furniture in the detention centres — or just sitting on the ground and holding their heads in their hands with their elbows on their knees, doing nothing, because there's nothing to do all day long except lying around and just counting the days in detention.
One thing that strikes me is in the middle of this grey we see a window.
Now, there is a window, and the window is meant to represent hope. And the window, of course, is characterised by the beautiful blue skies, which are obviously the beautiful blue skies of Malta, and the nice cotton-shaped clouds, and the green of the trees, which one can see from the window, but that's about it. Meanwhile, the detention centre is surrounded by a fence with razor wire and, of course, guards. Then, finally, the grey yields to white, and that is meant to represent a new future, a bright future. People are seen leaving the detention centre with some basic belongings on their heads and going out to the detention centre. And the final part of the picture shows women, men, children, people of different nationalities, of different complexions, all sharing the same united reality. And the last message says, stop racism, unity of all races and love to all people. And I would say that is the basic thing that one would hope for having left detention. We know that that is not yet the end of the problems for people who leave detention, but at least it might be a new beginning.
That was Jesuit Father Joseph Cassar, Director of Jesuit Refugee Service in Malta. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.